This is John McCurley, the CWA Oral History Project interviewer, and who am I here with?
This is Jeff Reckenbach. We are here in the District 4 office in Cleveland, Ohio, and it is August the 16th, 2023.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. And so as we talked about off the recorder, this is our second session together, and we ended last time with you going on staff. And so I wanted to pick the story back up there. Not necessarily a need to tell the specific story about how you ended up there, but really sort of getting us into some of the first assignments that you had.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I came on staff. I don't remember the exact year, to be honest. Early 80s. In January. Well, in fact, I can timeline it. It was January of 1981, because I remember as I first came on staff, my first week here, Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. So the winds had changed in terms of the view towards labor at that moment, unbeknownst to us that it would be as dramatic as it was. At any rate, that was when I started. My first assignment, we used to have a policy at CWA that when you came on staff, you didn't come on staff in the region that you were originally from. So me being from Cleveland, I wouldn't have been assigned to District 4, which was Ohio and Michigan. I would have been assigned to another state, and likewise, somebody that was put on staff in another area would fill the vacancy that I filled here in Ohio. But they changed that just before I came on staff. And so I was able to come on staff here in Cleveland, which was my home, and didn't necessitate a move, which was wonderful. But I think some of the thought process behind that remained. So I was assigned to work with locals in the southern part of the state. So I had what they called the 456 area, which was an acronym for the area codes of the area that I covered. 419 area, which was Toledo area, 513, which was Dayton, Cincinnati, and 614, which was Central Ohio, Columbus, and environs south from there. So that was my first assignment. I knew some of those people through my work as a local officer over the years prior to my coming on staff. But most of it was new territory for me, and it took a while to get to know people, build relationships up, and go from there. And
can I just stop you just for a second?
Sure.
And I mean that just to dig in a little bit to that, to the policy and the policy change.
Mm-hmm.
What was the rationale for the policy of not assigning staff to the areas they had come out of, and then why did it change?
I think I wasn't any part of the policy discussion or creation, but part of it seemed to be that, number one, you already had existing relationships, and how would those relationships influence the work that you were doing? So they wanted to sort of break that apart. And then there was also the notion of coming into an area as an unknown, you have slightly more gravitas as being this outsider. Nobody really knows what your background is, what your skill set is. They presume that you've got some skills because you've been promoted this job and given this assignment. So you at least walk in the door with a little mystery that generally tilts towards thinking you've got a level of expertise that can be useful. So I think that was the philosophy behind that program. And it seemed to fritter away, I think, largely because of the expense. So you would put somebody on staff. Part of the expense then of moving somebody from their hometown to another area completely, the union was obligated to pay the moving expenses for that individual. And then ultimately, as time went by, they would put in a transfer to come back to the area that they were from. And under the union contract with the staff union, the union would pay for that move to come back to the area that they were originally out of, and so you had that double expense of people bouncing around from one place to another. So I believe it was a financial decision ultimately that made them get rid of that that philosophy. But as I mentioned, it did sort of still extend where you would assign somebody outside of their home turf, so to speak. So. And it made some sense. I mean, it was good for me to actually go out and approach some tasks and problems without a preconceived notion of how things ought to have been done or should be done. And so it was a great learning experience for me and hopefully for them as well, as they got exposed to different ideas from somebody that was coming from a different perspective and point of view.
So what were some of those tasks, those problems, those ideas, and how did you reinvent yourself mm-hmm. as you came into this new
I'm not sure reinvent is quite the right word. We all grow over time and learn, and so we do change and evolve. So I certainly evolved as a result of moving down there, moving into that responsibility. It was clearly a different part of the country. In Ohio, we sort of joke that it's Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland, and then everything south of that is considered the South. And it's not more rural necessarily, although there are huge rural tracts all through Ohio. We do have other major cities, Columbus, Cincinnati, and then a whole tier of sort of second cities, Dayton, Akron, Canton, Toledo, Youngstown, all of which were at that point really beginning to feel the impact of deindustrialization, particularly places like Youngstown and Dayton were hit especially hard by jobs moving south or offshore. So I was put into this environment, if you will, with new folks, and so sort of had to establish myself in whatever way I could. And I felt like the best way was, it was always tough as a local president, running a meeting, getting people energized and interested in coming to a meeting. So right from the very start, I told all the locals that I had responsibility for, that I would come to any meeting that they had at any time. And so I spent a lot of time on the road just, becoming familiar with them, but also recognizing that there was some value I was providing to them by just being there. They were able to say, well, here's somebody that can explain why this contract article is what it is, or whatever the particular issue of the day happened to be. And so I did a lot of that. And it was a learning experience for me. So I can remember, I forget where exactly it was. It was the Zanesville local, I believe. And I got invited down to their membership meeting. And they held it in what had been an old barn that was converted. And, there were probably 20, 25 people there. It wasn't a big local, but, a decent turnout for a local that was maybe 150 members, something like that. So when you do the percentages, it was probably better than a lot of the urban locals in terms of turnout. So I went down there and I'm trying to fit in, but I mean, clearly I don't. I mean, this is a pretty rural area. I don't want to characterize them as just a bunch of good old boys, but they definitely were a different background than me growing up in Cleveland versus their background that had them growing up with probably acres and farmland and many of their parents were probably in the farm industry as well. Literally I hadn't been on staff for a month or so, and I didn't have a staff car that the union provides. I still was driving my Chevy Vega. And so I arrive, I do my spiel at the meeting, and a couple of guys come up to me afterwards and say, hey, we have a little get together afterwards where we just kind of hang out together. And I thought, well, it probably makes sense for me to do that, even though it is completely adverse to my personality. It's just not something I would ever voluntarily do. But it seemed like the right thing to do in terms of the job I had. So some of the people leave about, 10 or so are left afterwards, and I, hanging out with them. They say, we have a poker game that goes on. So I said, all right, deal me in, I'll play. Well, they clean me out. And I get out to my car, and it's practically on empty. And I have no cash to buy gas at this point. I'm not sure at that point in my life I had a credit card. So the whole way home, I'm thinking I'm not going to make it. And I finally wound up, I forget exactly where it was, but I decided I would take more of the back roads, thinking that that would be more efficient, that I wouldn't burn up the gas as quickly. But I forget where I stopped, and there was a 24-hour gas station. I went in and told the person my situation. They were very considerate. They gave me $5 worth of gas, which I was able to get home on. And I sent them a $5 bill. Actually, I sent them a $10 bill the next day to thank them for getting me home at probably midnight or 1 in the morning, whatever time it was. Didn't take me long to lose all my money, so it wasn't that late. But it was, for my part, it was part of trying to get myself feeling comfortable, or have them feeling comfortable with me more than me feeling comfortable with them. Okay, they took this city slicker, great, no problem. I was happy to be the foil. Many times in the future they would bring that up as I went down there, and I said, I've learned not to play cards with you people anymore. I'm done with that game. But the experiences were different some other ways as well. There were, because it was more of a lot of smaller locals, they tended to be more white male, all sort of what we would call plant problems. In the phone company vernacular, plant refers to the technicians that install, repair, linemen, people that serve the plant infrastructure of the telephone industry. So those locals tended to be completely dominated by those folks. And then you would go to Columbus, and you would find it was a much broader mix, although there were two locals in Columbus. There was what we called the plant local, and then the clerical local, which was operators clerical, as I think I talked about in my earlier session. And then there was Cincinnati. So Cincinnati was a separate company. It was partially owned by AT&T, but not wholly owned. And so it had a streak of independence that some of the other companies didn't have or couldn't have. And so that was part of my responsibility as well. And that also meant that they didn't fall into pattern bargaining. You had to bargain a contract with Cincinnati Bell. So I had to bargain essentially my first contract where I was completely responsible from top to bottom. And I had some really good local officers down there that helped me out. And also there was a fellow that came on staff just right after me, and he had been the president of the Cincinnati Bell local, so I was able to rely on him for some advice, Adrian Seifert. And he sort of told me where some of the pitfalls were, what some of the issues were, and that was very useful. I found his instruction there. But it was a little nerve-wracking, because now you feel this weight. It was different than being on bargaining committees. I'd been on bargaining committees in the past, but I wasn't chairing the committee. I was, one of the chorus that was chirping in and saying, hey, we need this or we need that, or, let's do one thing or another. Now I was the person that sort of had to sort through all of that, get a contract that ultimately would get ratified by the rank and file membership, which we did, but it was largely because I was working with some very experienced local officers who were able to sort of guide me through that process. There was an operator services local and clerical local down there. Mary Klosterman was the president of that local, and then Jerry Craver, who had taken over for Adrian Seifert when he came on staff, but had been a long time officer prior to that, were both a huge help in helping me navigate that. But I came away from that with sort of a renewed feeling of confidence. It was probably exactly the right kind of situation where it was a substantial unit. I don't want to minimize it. There were probably at the time maybe close to 4,000 employees working at Cincinnati Bell. Fairly good-sized unit. Wasn't Ohio Bell that had at that moment probably 30,000, 40,000 people working for them. But it was, it was significant enough that there were all of the issues that you would similarly have at any of the Bell units. So for me personally, that was that gave me a confidence that I hadn't had prior to that. I suppose some people, I do, at times suffer from this imposter syndrome where you don't feel like, boy, I don't know why they've got me doing this because I am not up to snuff on this. But that helped me sort of jump that shark and be able to feel comfortable with my abilities to do that. And I realized I just used a really poor and it jumped the shark really meant something else, but it was seemed to work there anyway.
Yeah, so. No. I think everyone understands what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, just to dig in a little, I'm curious. Yeah. Since this is the first one, the first, I don't know if you would describe the experience as a contract campaign, but mm-hmm. I mean, was there, could you sort of work us through in terms of what that would look like?
Sure.
In a CWA context during this era?
Yeah. Again, this is still in the era of very strict regulation in the telecom industry. So the contract negotiations, while contentious, didn't have the same kind of drama, maybe, that they did post-deregulation, where, at that point, Cincinnati Bell would go to the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, say, here's how much it costs us to run our business, and the Public Utilities Commission would say, very good, you're entitled to earn 8.5% or 9% over the top of that, and base their rate structure on earning a decent profit, not obscene, but a decent profit over the expense that it cost them to put that business on. And so we were negotiating in that kind of environment. And I think that helped ease some of the pressure, although you still felt it. I mean, you still wanted to get this done. You wanted to do it right. And it by no means was a walk in the park to get a deal done because there were all kinds of pitfalls. Employers obviously hate giving up control of anything, and that was certainly the case down there. In fact, in some ways, it was worse than it was at the Ohio Bells, the Michigan Bells of the world, because again, they were more independent than the other Bell system companies. I think AT&T owned 25% of them at the time, and at divestiture, they actually had to sell off their stake in Cincinnati Bell. And it went completely independent at that point. You still had a contract campaign. You ramped things up. You still had a deadline, that you worked towards. You worked within the offices, the garages, to get people aware of the contract. We did some early on contract meetings where the membership would show up and talk about the issues that were important to them, and those were always well attended. It was always the excitement coming up to a contract negotiation, what was going to happen, what we're going to get, and so we had those. We had a bargaining committee that then helped assemble all the demands that we had. And then to go out and work around those demands with the membership to get them engaged, give them some ownership of these bargaining demands. And that involved often more than just membership meetings, but going to some of these locations as well, going out to the garages, going out to the operator services offices, the service rep offices, even just doing a quick walkthrough to talk about it and just your... the presence there would hype the attention, hype the interest for the campaign. We got better at that as years went by. Again, I think out of necessity, because we are now dealing in a principally deregulated industry, and so we picked up better tools in the future of mobilizing the membership and engaging them in contracts. But you know, there's still rudimentary efforts at that point in time, and to a large extent they worked. The other advantage you had in these negotiations was the industry was popular. I mean, it was, this was your means of communication, everybody wanted to make sure their phone service worked on a regular basis, and so in general, the public supported the goals of workers to achieve a decent contract, and as time went on in the Reagan era, that began to flip over, where public affection for organized labor seemed to fall away to some degree, but I still think people respected those industries that they interacted with on a regular basis and the workers in those industries. You had the feeling that the public was going to be on your side as well.
Can I just ask a follow-up? Because I think it's interesting, since you have some recall of the specifics here, just to see if we can't get some change over time. Like, during this era, were you already doing, that's the phrase I'm looking for, things like button days or T-shirt days or informational pickets, or like, what were the mm-hmm. tools and techniques of that era?
So it was more about wearing the buttons, about, you'd have some bumper stickers, you'd put the flyers up. We hadn't started really the T-shirt days yet, although I think the next cycle around, by then we were, putting out the T-shirts, but you had the slogans. I don't remember what the slogans were down there, but, it was of the ilk of Ma Bell is a cheap mother, that kind of a thing was... was always the tried and true one. If you couldn't come up with something original, that became your default. Ma Bell's a cheap mother. There was definitely that, and it was more. But there was more engagement in person as well at that point. One of the things that in today is the era, you've got the ability to reach a lot of people instantaneously through, text messaging, email. We didn't have that then, and so there was more engagement person to person. And for better or for worse, you can make arguments why why it was better then or it's better now. There are definitely portions of each that work better. And as we grow, I think we're learning to use the new technology. I think we were slow to adapt some things when it came to technology, but I think the union, from what I can see right now, obviously, not having a direct role, has really caught up to speed and is using some of those tools more effectively than when we first had the opportunity. But there was more of that person-to-person engagement, where you had to go and talk about what the issues were. Where you had to share, with the membership, well, here's what they're trying to do, and as I say that, I think back, and it wasn't as much about here's what they're trying to do, in that era, this regulated industry, it was more about what we wanted. There was not as much about givebacks in terms of the company. They would try and give take back some control issues that the contract had constricted them with, but for the most part, it was, we want more of this, more of that, more of this thing. So, the minor pushbacks would be about how much more it was going to be, and then on their part, we want to, change the structure of this title so that we've got more flexibility to do whatever it happened to be. Or even potentially downgrade a particular title, but not like the things we dealt with later on in the late 80s and then through today, where we still confront confrontations over just hanging on to what we have, much less enhancing it or improving it. So there wasn't that sort of feel. There wasn't that as much of that tension. So you would build your contract around what's in it for us. What are our goals? You know, do we want more comprehensive health care or a better pension? It seems to me that through the late 70s and into the early 80s, pensions were a big deal. 30 and out became sort of a rallying cry. In other words, if you've worked here 30 years, you should be eligible to take your pension and walk away. And so that was likely part of the negotiations down there. And everybody kind of was pushing towards that goal of getting some fixed amount of time where you could actually say, yeah, okay, I've done it. I don't have to go all the way to 65. I started working here when I was 18. I put 30 years in. I can, in theory, go out when I'm 48. And to have that security is, even if you didn't advantage yourself of it, was a great security blanket. So that, as I'm thinking back, was one of the big issues that we would push on back in that era.
Were work rules a big issue?
Again, that's where the company would sort of push back. You know, they would want that additional flexibility. They wanted the ability to have repair clerks do more of the repair job. More diagnostic work. They wanted to downgrade some titles. Oh, we're putting this new technology in. That'll make it easier, so we shouldn't have to pay as much for this work to get done. That sort of thing was going on. But again, until deregulation, we would win most of those fights. I mean, those were just on the fringes in terms of the contract battles that we were in. I'm trying to think of a good example of one of the work rules that they would try and change on us. So we represent, this is sort of a bit of a fringe group, but we would represent the people that sell Yellow Page ads. And so, they would go out to, a plumber or, any kind of little industry and sell ads. And so part of our contract included what their compensation was going to be, and they were commission based, so we would set the rate of commission in our contract negotiations, and the company would ultimately always try to change it. Say, well, renewals are more important to us, so we're gonna downgrade the new and bump up the renewal, and then 3 years later, no, new sales are more important. We can retain the renewal, and there was this yin and yang all the time about trying to figure out where that was. The reality was, whatever you set it at, the salespeople would make it work for them. That's, if you were going to put a higher priority on renewals, they were going to do more renewals because it meant more money for them. And then likewise, on the other side, if you went for new sales, it was the same thing. But those kinds of things where the company would push back and want a little more control and tweak things in that interest. Not the best example in the telephone industry because it is such a minor part of it, and in fact now a non-existent part of it. I mean that the internet has wiped out, which I could get on a whole rant how the phone company let all that slip away. I mean, talk about a database. They had the database to end all databases and frittered that advantage away by not wanting to share it. So,
Maybe come to that. To that theme later. But I'm curious. One more question about this, and I promise we're going to move to divestiture. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about last time about the specific the context of the Ohio Bell system where you have the strike as this endpoint of the grievance mm-hmm. system. Presumably, you are now in the land of arbitration when you move
yes.
down here, and so. How did you adjust to that? What did you sort of learn from now being in this new context where you weren't prepping for a strike at the end of a grievance, but for arbitration?
Sure. That's interesting. I think that my background in coming from a contract without arbitration really sort of forced me to work harder to compromise on things and get things done. And so, you know, I can think of the time that I was with the Cincinnati Bell contract, we may have had one arbitration, you know, during that entire time. I always tried to work to get things done. Cause I hated to hand something off to somebody else and then just say, okay, it's, you know, it's in their hands and whatever comes of it comes of it. That just felt, my wife says I'm a control freak, that, you know, I have to be the one driving. And there's certainly elements of that in me. I get that. I plead guilty. And part of that comes through here as well. I hated the thought of just handing something else off to some basically disinterested party to flip a coin and decide, you know, what the future of something that I cared passionately about was going to be. So I'm sure we had an arbitration. I cannot remember a single arbitration case specifically that we had back in the time that I had the Cincinnati Bell assignment. I'm sure it happened, but it was my last resort. I spent a lot of time developing a relationship with the local officers, but also a lot of time developing a relationship with the labor relations folks down in Cincinnati. And I think, again, maybe it was just sort of the perfect situation for me without me knowing it, but I think the fact that they were independent from the Bell system in most ways, I think they wanted to keep control as well. I don't think they wanted to hand things off to somebody else to make a decision. So it probably was, as you know, on reflection, good for both of us in that time frame. I always felt uncomfortable about arbitration. It certainly has its place. I don't want to minimize that, and certainly, you know, used it in the past many times, but it just seemed like punting the ball, you know, when you handed it off that way. But there are times, you know, I think you get a case where, you know, it's not going to be a popular cause or case even among the rank and file, and you know, you really do want to give somebody their day in court, if you will, if you want to call an arbitration a court, and so you do that. But I cannot remember ever arguing an arbitration case at Cincinnati Bell, and that would have been my job. That would have been part of my responsibility to present an arbitration case, and I don't think I did that the whole time. First time I've ever really thought about that and put it in some kind of context. I'm guessing that's part of my motivation behind it, was I didn't want to hand off that control, because we certainly had, you know, I mean, people were getting fired and people were having issues on the job. There was always overtime issues, you know, how overtime's getting distributed. Mandatory overtime in some of the contracts, and you know how that worked. So you know, you always had pushback on that. But I found, you know, the tough ones were the dismissals, you know, and those would be the ones that, in you know, going forward, would be the ones that we wound up having to arbitrate. But you know, when you're dealing with an overtime issue, when you're dealing with a scheduling issue, I always felt like you could work your way through it. You know, if you could listen to what the other side was saying, if you could listen to what the management was saying, you didn't have to agree with it, but you had to sort of get behind what their motivation was. And if you could do that, you could generally figure out a way that would work for both sides and get something done. And that was always my goal.
Well, just on the other side, again, I'm just super curious because, mm-hmm. you know, this is before divestiture. Mm-hmm. Were there ever moments also where there were still these kinds of what we might call today like walks on the boss, or like, you know, efforts to try to, you know, to resolve something in the moment that was going on? I won't say like wildcat. Well, I will say
yeah.
wildcat. You know.
Yeah, there definitely were. I mean, there would be, you know, even in Cincinnati Bell with a no strike clause and arbitration is resolved, there were still wildcats. You know, somebody in a particular location, a garage, or more often a garage than the larger workplaces, because it's just easier to coordinate when, you know, it's 25 individuals versus 150 individuals in one place, where they would, you know, get upset about a particular issue, and this is it, we're taking off. I don't remember specifically any of those, but I know they happened because, you know, I just have a regular memory of being, you know, called by the labor relations guy, hey, you know, the garage on such and such avenue is out, what's going on, and, you know, calling down to the local, finding out what the situation was, because we were generally the last to know at the national union that this was going on. And so, you know, the call would come from the company first, and then I would call down to the local, and the local would fill me in. Oh, so-and-so, they've messed up the overtime list, or they've suspended, you know, this guy because he was at the coffee shop for too long, you know, those kinds of things. And you could generally work your way through those by just talking it through with what the leadership was. And a lot of times it was, I think the local deliberately knew it was sort of their way of kicking the ball upstairs, and also knowing that if they did that, you know, they could a compromise could be reached that they didn't have to take, you know, the responsibility for compromising on something. So, you know, the guy got a 5-day suspension, we made it a 1-day suspension, and he's back to work, and everybody's happy. They feel like they won, but they didn't win everything, and so, you know, it moves along like that. So, even without the presence of a no strike clause, or even with the presence of a no strike clause, they still would go out on wildcats. And I suppose part of it also is a recognition that, you know, something like that wasn't likely to reach arbitration anyway. You know, that wouldn't likely meet the threshold for, you know, for taking it to an arbitration hearing. So there was perhaps that level of frustration as well. And you don't have to show up. And you didn't have as militant an employer then either. So there was, you know, you didn't feel the threat of being locked out, or that, you know, the guys were all going to be fired that walked out of the garage, or you know, that somebody was going to be, you know, disciplined as a leader of, you know, the 50 operators that walked out, you know, because of a suspension of another one. So, you know, there was sort of that feeling as well, and more present in clearly the contract where we didn't have arbitration, but it still existed in all our other contracts as well, where people would, you know, take things into their own hands. And, you know, frankly, I mean, it was a good union building tactic. I mean, people, again, you know, I think the thing that we to this day don't do a great job is giving, you know, the members the ownership of their contracts, of the issues in the workplace, you know, particularly from that period from the 80s through the 90s, there was sort of this vending machine view of a labor contract. I put my money and I pay my dues, I expect a result. You know, I expect my, you know, bottle of pop to come down the chute, or my candy bar. And, excuse me, you know, that doesn't work. I mean, that model of unionism just doesn't pan out. I can't even count the number of times, you know, you hear the phrase, I pay my dues. Yeah, that's not everything that being a union is about. Yeah, I pay my dues too. I still pay dues. I pay dues to this day to my local union. As it's about being a part of something. It's about being part of, you know, a collective that can make a difference in the way that you live your life. And you have to give more into that than just a financial contribution. The financial contribution keeps the lights on, pays the bills. But, you know, the real work of the union is actually, you know, participating, being a part of this, and not just counting on, well, I pay 1.5% of my salary towards the union, that should take care of all my problems. And you know, particularly in that time frame under regulation, there was some of that sense that I paid, therefore I want my service, and I was entitled to that by the money that I was putting out.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, and the reason I ask is, you know, there's oftentimes this sense that you know you have Taft-Hartley or you know what have you, and that you know suddenly all these doors are closed, whereas in fact you know a lot of these tools and techniques change but stay you know within the ecosystem of workers' ability to build power in the workplace, and so just being able to chart how long those things continue to be viable is really valuable from a historical point of view, without saying one is better than the other necessarily.
Yeah, right.
So I feel like we've done enough of this kind of, unless you feel like there's another example here.
No. I'm ready to go wherever you want to go.
Okay. So, and the idea here, we'll be able to sort of see like, check back in on the other side of divestiture to see how things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you come in right before this process of this legal process of deregulation/divestiture starts. There in 1982, 1983, 1984. So could you sort of walk us through how that monumental process impacted this day-to-day work that you had, you know, you'd been working for a decade, and then suddenly this everything's I try not to characterize it. Then suddenly there's this change.
Right. Yeah, the change at the moment felt very radical, but that was just at the moment. And then sort of as after the announcement, it felt like, okay, well, you know, we're going to go on and life will go on, and in terms of deregulation. You know, because you didn't feel the impact right away. You heard, and so you knew it was significant, but it didn't impact it immediately, but as it started to, as the companies recognized that, whoa, we're in a whole new world here. I'm not going to get my guaranteed rights anymore. I don't have sole hold on the industry. You really began to get a sense that, okay, this is a whole new world, and it most immediately came. In the long distance business. So all of a sudden you had, with AT&T and the telephone industry in general, you know, very tight parochial view of the telephone network and tight controls on it. You know, you can't put anything on our network. Our network is too valuable for anybody to tinker around with. We can't afford to allow that to happen. We will control what you have and what you don't have in terms of telecommunications infrastructure. And then, you know, the MCIs of the world appear and say, hey, you know, you can call grandma on Mother's Day for, you know, a fraction of what you're paying AT&T. And, you know, the big joke of the time frame was, you know, all the calls you were getting from long distance carriers trying to get you to switch your carrier. And so that was really the first place that we felt that immediate impact of deregulation, that, you know, wow, this is really changing here. And so there was a sense, even sort of a debate internally about, well, how do we deal with this? I mean, part of the notion was, look, we've got to protect the infrastructure we have in place. With the telecom industry that's already there, because we represent those workers. We don't represent the workers at MCI. On the other hand, when we got in a battle with AT&T, is it to our interest to use MCI as leverage or the others? I mean, I use MCI because that was really the big one that sort of more than any other seemed to make the dent in the industry, ultimately, you know, just blowing the long distance industry completely up. Pulling the curtain back on the wizard that you know, you didn't need this one pipeline to make these things happen. So
you know, as you thought about mobilizing against an employer like that, you were really on the edge of the sword, trying to figure out, well, you know, we don't want to lose customers because that means we lose jobs, but at the same time, you know, if we can make them feel the pressure here. So I could remember one campaign where the notion was to collect cards from our friends and neighbors saying that they would switch their long-distance carrier if they didn't come to a contract agreement with us. And then we would hold those cards and use those as leverage and turn them in, you know, to, if in fact we couldn't get a contract. It was mildly successful. But, you know, again, was a little dangerous in terms of job loss and the impact it would have on jobs and, going forward. But it was really, to my estimation, the first time we actually began to think outside the box in terms of mobilizing beyond just the routine that we'd had in a very regulated industry. It got us thinking about, well, how do we leverage, you know, whatever we can out there to help us achieve contracts that we think are fair for our members by using, you know, other resources, by bringing other groups into play, you know, in this instance, customers. You know, we'd had some of that in the past, but, you know, it was just, it wasn't really engaging the customer. It was just trying to make us sympathetic to the customers. And they generally were. I mean, they, you know, there were enough telephone company employees in every jurisdiction that you were bound to have a neighbor that worked at the phone company. And so, you know, oh, yeah, you know, Susie works at the phone company and, you know, she's a great gal. And, you know, I hope she gets what she's striving for in her contract. So this was the first time I feel like we actually tried to do something innovative and reach out. And I think in many ways, you know, my labor history is not as good as it could be. But it seemed like, no, I take that back. You know, I guess the farm workers really were the innovators in that regard. You know, I can remember in high school, boycott lettuce, boycott grapes, boycott wine that Gallo makes, even though I couldn't buy wine at that point. But, you know, standing in front of the grocery store with a group of others. So, you know, it was the first venture that we made into that sort of realm of the world where we would more intentionally engage consumers in our struggle.
Well, were you, you know, because this is also the era of the corporate campaign. I mean, I think this is maybe what we're sort of pointing towards, but things like, you know, again, like I come out of Iowa, right? So the sort of cram your spam, mm-hmm. you know, these kinds of things. You right. know, was that a, what's the question here? I mean, it just, was CWA intentionally pivoting in that direction?
I suppose you could say it was intentionally pivoting. I mean, it was a conscious decision to, you know, get these cards signed that people would pledge to switch their long distance carrier if we didn't get a good deal. It was interesting. It wasn't like a cram your spam saying, you know, don't buy spam at all. It was saying, don't make me use this. You know, it was like, and you know, I I can still remember the cartoon of, you know, the guy pointing the gun at his own head and saying, "Don't laugh, you're next." And you know, it wasn't at that level. We were a little timid about that. We didn't really want to say, "Well, you know, we're going out and soliciting for MCI." Part of it was there was a little difference. You know, boycotting lettuce. Once the boycott is over, you're going to buy lettuce. And, you know, if you like spam, you know, when after the cram spam, that's what I'm going to go buy. In this instance, once you made the switch, you've probably lost that customer forever. You know, there wasn't something to replace spam on the shelf. That was a pretty unique product. And likewise, lettuce or grapes or, you know, I mean, it was, I can remember, you know, going into grocery stores trying to find out where the lettuce or the grapes came from, and You know, it just clearly people weren't, you know, most people weren't at that level trying to figure out exactly what the origin of the product was. So there was that fear that that you were actually changing the baseline permanently versus you know, just that threat. So we were trying to figure that out and trying to, and again, I say we, but I wasn't one of those we's. I was a soldier at that point and just, you know, following, you know, what the direction was. I certainly, you know, I recognized the dilemma and empathized with, you know, the challenge of it for the leadership at the time trying to work their way through it. I thought I liked the notion of the campaign. It seemed to be just the right, you know, sort of way to nuance this, because I, you know, I certainly didn't want to see the base of jobs at the telephone company get eroded. I, you know, I wanted to sort of protect. And during that time, we actually worked very often collaboratively with the phone company when it came to legislative initiatives, when it came to regulation. You know, I spent many hours in Columbus with the state legislature advocating for common interests that we had with the phone company, and with some great success. You know, it was they recognized the value we brought to that equation, because, you know, while they could round up most of the Republican votes in Ohio at the time, it was a Democratic state, and the legislature, both houses of the legislature, were usually run by Democrats. And so to have the union guy show up and say, yeah, this is a good thing for jobs, made a big difference for where they were at. And we used that leverage as well. I mean, you know, we would say, look, you know, we're going to do this. Here's what I need. You know, you didn't make it, wasn't exactly quid pro quo, but, you know, there was certain elements of that as well, in it as well. And the most famous example of that wasn't out of this district. I think you'll be talking to folks in District 6, although I don't think, well, the architect of it is long since passed away. But Vic Crowley, who was the vice president in District 6, at the same time I was, well, we overlapped somewhat on the board. But at any rate, Vic Crowley famously with Southwestern Bell said at a time when they were branching out into wireless technology for the first time in a major way. I mean, you had car phones for years, but where it was becoming more of a ubiquitous technology. He told the company when they wanted him to do something with the Texas legislature, yeah, I'll help you out, but I want card check for that wireless industry. I want, you know, you to recognize the union if we show you that we've got a majority of the members in there that are interested in having a union. And they agreed. And that's, you know, talk about somebody leaving a legacy. That's a legacy that has impacted this union probably larger than almost any other. You know, you can make the argument we've done public sector organizing that's brought lots of members in, mergers, those sorts of things. But in terms of really changing a dynamic within a union, that piece right there, and then the rest of us were able to ride those coattails and parlay that into, you know, so when I was the vice president up here, I used that same leverage in dealing with Ameritech. Say, hey, you know, I got to have this. They've done this down in Southwestern Bell, your singular wireless company up here. I got to have recognition at it. And then that, of course, later on actually became a fait accompli because SBC took over Ameritech. And so that cleared the path. I mean, clearly they were already down that road, and this was going to be the way that they were going to continue to operate. And to their credit, they were true to their word. I mean, they recognized the union and to this day still, you know, have been the only unionized wireless carrier in the country. There are a couple of phone cellular stores in the Verizon footprint that have been organized more recently, but not at the wall-to-wall level that that AT&T, now AT&T Wireless, is.
Well, what do you think about this analogy? Because it's what it strikes me is that this is actually a lot like the building trades, you know, in the sense that, you know, you have, it's a highly competitive industry. People are like, the barriers to entry into it don't seem to be, they're falling at the very least. And so there's this big distinction between union contractors, if you will, and non-union contractors, and which is creating this incentive to figure out ways, you know, the incentive on certain companies in order to find ways that they can work with and leverage unionization in certain ways. And of course, there's an obvious an incentive from the point of view of CWA. Mm-hmm. Does that feel like a reasonable analogy here?
Yeah, I think it is. It's to Vic's credit and the union's credit that they recognized this leverage point and used it to build the union. And one of the things, when I came on staff, my first boss was Marty Hughes, who I mentioned in our first session, a controversial figure within CWA, but just absolutely fixated on building the union. And any time I negotiated a contract while working for Marty, whether it was a preform line products with 50 people on the east side of Cleveland, or with Ameritech with 100,000 employees, the first question he had was, what did you get for the union? What was in this for the union? What did you do to build the union in this contract? You knew what the question was, and so you walked into those negotiations with that mindset. Yeah, I'm going to do things that are going to improve the lives of the members here, but what am I going to do that's going to build the union coming out of this contract? And so that really became sort of the philosophy around here, is that you could not come back with a contract that didn't have something in it to help build this union, whether it was getting increased time off the job for local officers, or recognition of a unit that hadn't been recognized in the union before. You had to have something. And if you didn't, you were going to go back, and that was not going to be a deal. Because before you signed off on any contract, you had to check in with the district vice president. So even before, you know, the bargain committee said yes, I had to come back and give an outline. Here's what we've got on the table. Here's what I think we're going to get. And, you know, are you going to be okay on signing off on that? So you'd run all that by the regional vice president. And so knowing that was going to be the question, you from day one, I would pull my counterparts off to the side and say, look, I got to have something here. I got to have something that's going to build the union. Sometimes it was, I want a checkoff for political action, whatever it was going to be something that was in there that made the union more efficient, and gave us the opportunity to build in the future off of it.
Well, so that's really interesting too, because we're in this era here in the late 80s where there's definitely the flip side of that, right, is the kind of the philosophy, the concessionary philosophy of, you know, how can we shrink and survive, and not necessarily always worrying about, or at least this is the critic of of some of this concessionary orientation during this era, not necessarily thinking about what you were just saying, right? You know, how can we always, even as we're trying to survive, find ways to build the union? And so that seems like a real important philosophical distinction that's happening here in the CWA during this era.
Yeah, it certainly was happening here in this region. I mean, that was the notion. You had to somehow build the union out. Clearly it was happening, with Vic Crowley down in District 6. I mean, he saw this and used that leverage to build the union down there in very meaningful ways, in a nascent industry that just exploded, now has, thousands of employees across the country that are in the union because in Texas they wanted something in that Texas legislature that we helped them get. It's a philosophy. I wouldn't say it was universal across CWA, because as I talked with colleagues over the years, you know, there was, I never got that sense that some of them had that same mindset. And they say, well, you know, it's all about the members, and I get it. It is all about the members, but the members are better off if the union is stronger too. It was a growing theme, but, you know, to Marty Hughes's credit, and again, you know, a guy that has been bashed by others over the years for other issues. This was always what he was about. That was always, he would, for example, when we were negotiating with the phone company, and, you know, I'd be in with the bargaining committee, he'd then, as we got close to the end, he'd be in, check into the hotel that we were at, and I would have to go to his room and tell him, here's where we're at, here's what we got. Answer the door in his pajamas and okay, I need this. We got to have, whatever it happened to be for helping to build the union. And you knew, I mean, you just absolutely knew it, that you weren't going to get a contract without something in it for us going forward. And when I say for us, it wasn't in the form of any kind of monetary relief necessarily. There may have been some element of that, for example, getting extended leaves of absence for staff representatives, which at the end of the day, if I continued, for example, I was on a leave of absence with a phone company, so I continued to accrue time for my pension, and then my CWA pension would be lessened by that. I mean, they would deduct that piece out of my overall pension. Which was, helped build the union, frankly, because it helped keep us on a more firm financial foundation. But it had to be something, and it seemed to grow as the notion of mobilization efforts came about, because you really were trying to get recognition for other groups. You know, we would have contract fights over getting recognition over groups, and that did get blunted somewhat, obviously, in the era of concessions, where you really were at the table just trying to survive, just to keep your head above water. I think continues largely today, where, you're still in this concessionary environment, principally, it seems, around health care, but pensions as well. I mean, the whole pension system is being eroded as more and more employers go to 401ks and other ways of avoiding their, what I think is their responsibility to workers, to provide them with a healthy retirement.
Well, so I think maybe I should just put a point on this. So how much do you feel like that bargaining to organize approach originates with the CWA out of this kind of unique set of characteristics? Was this something that you feel like, really came from the CWA, or something the CWA borrowed from somewhere else?
It does in my view, but again, I won't pretend to know, all of the origins of it, but it does seem to have come out of CWA largely, and I would credit some of the leadership that we've had over this past decade. Morty Barr, a very innovative leader, and then Larry Cohen, who was just a brilliant strategist around these kinds of issues, and his whole mindset was, how do we build this union? How do we organize out of the work that we're doing at the bargaining table, in the workplace? That was always the mindset that he brought to the job, and that rubs off. I mean, people get that. Now, you'll have some people, some locals, that resent that and think that all their job is to handle grievances and, handle problems in the workplace. And that's certainly part of their job. But, they can improve that part of the job by doing these other things as well. There is the opportunity to strengthen the union, to give them more power than when they get to the bargaining table, by engaging in more of these other activities that help to build the union out. But I would say those two leaders were exactly the right leaders at the right time in an industry that, you know, has largely been decimated by deregulation, competition. Seeing what's happened in the telecom industry has just been a real tragedy. I wish we were more successful, I guess, at trying to protect those jobs and save those jobs. I get very frustrated knowing that if I call AT&T with a service problem, I'm likely to reach somebody overseas. That we didn't have the strength or the power to keep those jobs here. I can't imagine that happening at a time in this nation where a third of the workforce was part of the labor movement. It happens now because, 10% of the workforce is in a union, and it seems like it's easier to get away with that kind of thievery, where you can take jobs and ship them to a low wage area. While I like to give us credit for being successful and helping, to keep things going, the level of success isn't, what we ever hope for. But I guess that's true in almost any negotiation at any time. I've never walked away from a bargaining table satisfied that I got everything I could get. Did I think I got everything I could get at the moment? Yes. But did I get everything I think I wanted or was entitled to? No. You just, you wind up at the end of the day getting the best deal you can at that moment and taking it and live to fight another day. And that live to fight another day piece, I think, gets overlooked too many times. What am I doing to help live to fight that other day? Living in the moment is fine, but, thinking about where I'm going to be in the future and how I get to that future, it ought to be every bit as important in these negotiations as anything else that we deal with. So that philosophy, was ingrained in us here. We knew that we had to build this union and do whatever it took to build it, and did that to a large extent. But again, with not the level of success that that any of us would have hoped for. And when I look at today's telecommunications industry, and part of it was, I still think there was sort of the mindset that I came at the MCI struggle with, where I was really more focused on protecting the jobs within AT&T than thinking about the competition, when I really should have been more focused on organizing the MCIs of the world, organizing these competitors, and that realization came to me a little after that, but not long after that, that you began to think about, well, how do we level off this playing field? When AT&T introduced their UVerse product, which was their cable TV product, and the technicians installing UVerse didn't make as much as the telephone company technicians, and the humor, oh, this is terrible. I said, there's one way to solve this. We got to go out and organize these other cable technician workers. I mean, this is the pool they're drawing from, and if the Spectrums or the whatever Spectrum used to be, I forget now. If they're paying $15 an hour for a technician to install cable, it makes it harder for us to negotiate to give a guy $40 an hour to install that same cable. That dynamic was still out there because a lot of locals just were concerned about the ones that were here versus the ones that weren't, and not thinking about how bringing the ones that weren't into the fold would actually improve the lot for the ones that were here as well. They just saw them as competitors taking our jobs away versus, they're in the same industry and it's an industry look that we ought to be focused on and trying to address rather than, just our parochial view of, give me mine and don't worry about the other guy.
I have a couple questions about that. Do you mind if I sort of drill into that a little bit. And my goal here is to try to, you know, do maybe 20 more minutes and then sort of get you to the point where you become, we start to move out of this role and move up. So, but I want to dig into this a bit. So one question before I ask about the sort of new organizing piece, I want to ask about seniority, because it's one of the things that I should have asked Jim Irvine in our interview the other day, but now it was really interesting to me, is this question of seniority and how that affects this process. And like, so here's my hypothetical. Like, let's say that you are a longstanding AT&T Long Lines employee, and then all of a sudden all of that work starts to go away. Do you have any kind of transfer rights into a local Bell, and are you trying to use those transfer rights to bump people out so that you can stay employed? Is that, was that going on?
So after post divestiture, that couldn't go on. So there was an imaginary wall that was placed. Even in some buildings, they would put a piece of tape down the floor. This part is AT&T Long Lines. This part is the operating company that was split off from AT&T. And so you didn't have that ability to go from one place to the other. There was some mobility that you had internally. So, you know, if AT&T was shutting down an operation in Cleveland, they may say, well, we've got opportunities in Columbus, or even Atlanta, Georgia, that kind of a thing. Now, you know, it depends where you were at your lot in life, whether or not a move of your family and, you know, your roots was going to be worth, you know, taking that risk. And, you know, often people would opt not to, and some would. And I think you're going to interview Ralph Maley, a good friend of mine, and he was in Buffalo, New York, and they said, well, you know, we're closing this factory here, this Western Electric factory, and if you want, you can go to Atlanta, Georgia. And he went to Atlanta, and then part of Atlanta gets closed, and, you know, so people wind up bouncing around, and that experience then chills anybody else, you know, willing to take that risk and make that move. Well, wait a minute, you know, they're moving from Buffalo to Atlanta, and then, you know, then Atlanta closes, now I got to go to Oklahoma City or, you know, wherever else it happens to be. It doesn't feel as secure. So, you know, the notion is, all right, I'm just going to go start somewhere else. Now, if you're with 28 years of service and waiting to get that magic 30 number, you'll probably go to the ends of the earth to grab that. And, you know, even if it means, you know, temporarily relocating from your home for a couple of years you know, living in an apartment or something. But there were those kinds of opportunities. Now, they weren't universal. That didn't always happen. They didn't always say, you know, here's what's going to happen. What largely happened and that we would negotiate with the employers about was to create an incentive for those high seniority people to leave a little earlier, to say, okay, you've got 28 years. We'll give you these last 2 years and this little bonus to go ahead and take an early retirement. And people, and the downside of that was once you made one of those offers, then nobody would leave until another offer was made, you know, so you would sit around, and even though you had, you know, you had enough seniority to go and leave, you'd say, well, I'm going to wait till they make another offer. I want to get the offer. And so you wind up with these spikes, you know, people leaving when there's an offer, and then you'd get a big valley afterwards because people would be just sitting back. You know, there would be some people would leave, you know, family circumstance, whatever it happened to be. But, you know, you would be waiting for that big offer. You'd wait for that bonus. You know, they're giving me a year's pay to go early. Oh, okay, I'm you know, I'll take that and I'll go now. But in many ways it was actually a more humane way to deal with it, and it made sense from the employer's perspective because it hopefully enabled them to keep some of the younger people who, you know, were probably more attuned to the new technology than the older hands who were used to the old, you know, telco way of doing business. And so we had a lot of those sorts of, you know, peaks and valleys over the next even today, you know, you still have people that are going to wait until they make an offer. You know, it's everybody's waiting for that bonus to go ahead and retire. Now, some of that also changed. One of the other things that the company did that I personally opposed at the time but was overruled on was beginning to offer lump sum pensions. So you would calculate the value of your pension and use, you know, an annuity table to figure out your life expectancy and, you know, how much it would be over a period of time. And so you could, for just to throw a number out there, you could walk away from the phone company for $275,000. Here's your $275,000. This is your pension. You do with it what you want. Now, if you just put it away and draw, you know, an annuity off of that, you know, in theory, this should last for as long as we think you're going to live, what the actuarial tables tell us that you will live. I was just opposed to that in principle because and maybe it's not fair. I think it's just too risky. You know, I think too many people make bad decisions about it. And I know that sounds, you know, very paternalistic, but I'm sorry that it does, but it just I saw too many people early on. They first offered it to management. They said, you know, and of course they offered to management, and then it becomes a buzz among non-management. Oh, you know, they got a lump. He walked away with, you know, $250,000. And you're thinking, wow, that's, you know, this is huge, $250,000. Oh my gosh, I'd be set forever. What a great, you know, a great deal. And so there was already sort of a drumbeat within the phone company that, you know, we should go to this. This is something we want. And you know, I just pushed back on it. I said, look, the employer should be obligated to, well, what if I die tomorrow? Then my kids could have this money. Okay. Yeah, but what if you live to your 105? You know, you're going to have to live off of this for the next 40 years instead of, you know, the next 5 years. And having this big pool sort of ensures you that you're going to be taken care of over that period of time. I lost that fight. I mean, it was just too popular among people. They all wanted it. And today that still is very popular. And so what you find happening now is the actuarial tables use interest rates to calculate what that amount of money should be. And so just here recently, interest rates went way up, which meant you could get a bigger return, which meant you got a lower lump sum. You know, projecting that, okay, I can now earn 8% on this money when I was only earning 2 in the past. Well, if you went and took the lump sum when you were earning 2, you got way more money, because the projection was you were going to only earn 2% for the next umpteen years. So you wind up getting spikes like that now. And this affects the union, too, because then the union did go to a lump sum pension, which I tried to steer us back from when I became Secretary of Treasury. In fact, I put in this paternalistic notion. I know that's not right. It shouldn't be that way. But I even offered half and half. You could take half in a lump sum, but take half as a regular annuity from the employer. It didn't go over. I mean, it didn't take the way I'd hoped it would, because that way you'd have some security. You know, you had something going forward, and if you frittered away your lump sum, you still had something. But to get back to where we were with this, I mean, so that was the other way of trying to work through these surpluses as you went forward. And once you've done that a couple of times, then you've basically pulled out everybody you're going to pull out. And so that's when the layoffs actually really start to hit. And that's when, you know, you try and scramble to find people jobs wherever it happens to be. And at least initially, there was some ability to do that, you know, because you could say, all right, this location is going to need people. And because we got a higher take on the early pension offer out of Columbus. And so if you're in Cleveland, instead of being laid off, you can go down to Columbus and work there. Of course, then that changes again as the industry reemerges together. And now, instead of saying, you know, from Cleveland to Columbus, now you're going to go from Cleveland to Houston, or Cleveland to San Antonio, or Cleveland to St. Louis. And it makes it a little more daunting to make that move. But there was always the notion, whatever we could do to minimize the layoffs was going to be a critical part of any negotiation. But at the end of the day, there were still going to be people after you've pulled all the possible strings that you can. People are, you wind up having to see people laid off the job. So, I mean, it's been a difficult time in this industry. I mean, it's been a real challenge watching it just be completely transformed in my lifetime. I mentioned in my first session, I worked in the payphone department. There's no payphones anymore. Nobody has a payphone. Very few people have landlines. I don't know what the number is. I'll bet it's less than half Americans. Half of Americans have landlines. And I would venture that most of those are over the age of 65. So as they die, so will the landline business. We've got connections to our homes so that we've got the internet, so we've got our television, so we've got, our music, whatever else is coming through that pipe, whether it's copper or fiber. We haven't done a good enough job of organizing the rest of the industry. There's still plenty of jobs out there, and we just haven't been able to crack that nut. So when you look at a leader like Cohen, who I talked about before, recognizing that and recognizing that the solution to that probably isn't internal, that it really is about labor law reform and making it easier for workers to organize. That's where the emphasis ought to be. Larry was brilliant in that regard, but he didn't have sort of a lobbyist personality, to kind of make the argument. One of the smartest guys I've ever known, probably the smartest guy I've ever known, and able to think strategically, but just tough to get all of our colleagues in the movement to come along to that point of view. When you've got so many of them that are just, sitting on what they've got, and I'll hold at this point. I'll just I'll play this out because I'm at this point in my career and I don't have the energy or the forethought to go out there and reach a little bit. But we need to. I mean, we can't fix this problem internally in CWA. The steel workers can't fix it internally in the steel industry and all the industries there and the UAW, but we can I think about the UAW and all of these factories that these foreign competitors have built in the United States. I mean, they recognize the value of having the factory here. I mean, there's supply chain, there's all kinds of issues, and they've made a conscious decision. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I'm going to put my plant in South Carolina. Or I'm going to put my plant in Tennessee or wherever it happens to be. And you're just thinking about what labor law reform would do to the United Auto Workers. It's probably a clearer example than the telecom industry. But the telecom industry is the same way. People's homes are still getting wired. People are still getting, they're using wireless phones. There's still an industry that requires people power to make it work, and we ought to be representing all those people that are making that happen, and we don't, and it's largely because we can't, because of the way the labor laws are structured today, where the employer can play it however they want. They can make the unit as small as they want or as large as they want, depending on what their perception is of how things are going to go. So I don't know. I don't have the answer. I don't know how we make that change. We had a couple of windows where we failed to make it happen. We had a filibuster majority in the Senate, and we had the House in the first couple of years of the Obama administration. He put his emphasis on health care. I get it. I mean, I fully understand that. But I think we could have done a few things in the meantime. I think we could have walked and chewed gum at the same time. Obama was a wonderful president, but he was not He's not a Joe Biden. He didn't know doesn't know how to get things done in the legislature. Biden, to his credit, has just been he was not my first, second, third, fourth choice for the nomination this last go round, but he has accomplished things that are just remarkable, and to his credit, and he gets he gets pilloried for a lot of it, but I can only imagine if we'd had a Biden presidency, we would have card check now. We would have labor law reform. He's done amazing things with scant majorities. Anyway, that's it's going down a completely different path.
Well, it's okay, but let me. So I'm gonna ask one more sort of specific question that's gonna take us back to the 80s and 90s in mm-hmm. order and to sort of wrap this piece up, if that's all right.
Sure.
So, and it's just to kind of put a again to sort of put some bones on the big ideas we've been talking about. So, I think I'm right. Tell me if I'm right about this. That here in this moment when the big changes, of course, happen most quickly and dramatically in long distance, mm-hmm. And then you've got they're slower to happen in the baby bells, mm-hmm. And so where are I want to use MCI again as the example. So mm-hmm. is it a matter of MCI plants, being operated or at least initially, in the same territory, like MCI would open up whatever kind of facility they needed to operate, in New York or in Cleveland or in LA. And so there really were these new facilities operated by non-union employers that could have been targets for new organizing but weren't, or were but campaigns were failing. That's what we've got before we get the offshoring, mm-hmm. right? Before those call centers go overseas. That's what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, MCI and a lot of those long distance companies that popped up back at the first point of deregulation didn't have a lot of infrastructure. They were able to use existing networks, and so their employee base was much smaller. Their employee base was basically a sales operation, and so it was really hard to crack that. And that was part of the resentment, in the industry was, look, these guys are riding on the network that we built, and they're getting essentially a free ride on it. They're buying bundled service and then reselling it to consumers at a rate much lower than what the phone company was offering. And so there was that resentment. But, to be fair, we didn't target the pieces that we could have targeted at MCI. They still had call centers. Somebody was, when you saw the commercial for MCI, to call MCI, or MCI was calling your phone on a daily basis to ask you to switch. People were doing that. Those were human beings. And it was just such a jolt to us. I think we just went into the hunker down mode right away instead of punching out. Our best attempt at punching out was, saying, oh, we'll ask people to switch if you don't behave. Well, that wasn't really going to fix the problem in the long term. That industry was going to continue to erode. I certainly didn't foresee it eroding to the level that it did, where long distance is completely free now. I have a sister in Germany. I can call for free, which would have been a fortune back in the day. Our initial reaction was just a defense posture, and not to use a sports analogy, but in this instance, the best defense would have been a good offense, and just going on the offense against MCI and trying to organize it. And we did. Some efforts on it, but they were just on the surface. I mean, we really never said it is worth our while to invest big sums of money in organizing this industry. Part of that does come from it's a tough lift with existing locals and members to say, we ought to be spending some of your resources on giving these people over here who are eating your lunch right now a union. You know, so you got that resentment factor. I think we've overcome that largely at this point. People recognize now, for the most part, again, I'm 11 years removed from this. But it does feel like we've gotten ourselves through that and are in a better place when it comes to regards that. But we weren't at the outset. And that window that might have been open, I don't know how wide it was open, you know, might have just been cracked open, I don't know. But we didn't try and jimmy it all the way open and go through it at the moment, myself included. I mean, I was a staff at that point, and I was just, you know, fixated on, I got plenty of problems here, you know, I got 99 problems, and MCA ain't one in my world. So, you know, I was working on servicing, and that's part of the, you know, what we missed at that point, that, you know, you could service better if you would actually organize more. And that's what Morty brought. He brought Cohen on as an executive vice president, recognizing his organizing skills. And then Cohen, you know, obviously just over a period of time, then just changed us to a more organizing focused culture. You'll talk with others that have been around over the past decade or so to see how that culture has sustained in a post-Cohen world, you know, whether that continues to go on. I think it does. I mean, it seems like it does. It seems like there's a much more robust organizing structure within the union than there certainly was when I was around. In my time on staff, Marty Hughes, the vice president then, was focused on organizing public workers, and we had a big public worker campaign. He helped get a governor elected. We passed the collective bargaining law here in the state of Ohio, and then we went about very aggressively trying to organize those workers. We had a number of folks come in from around the country to help us do that. You know, hindsight is 20/20. They had a philosophy of we're gonna organize these small units all over the state, and we'll build up this momentum and perception that we now are the public employee union. and so we did that, and we had, I forget what it was, 20 some victories in a row, 20 organizing victories in a row, but, you know, they were largely 20 people here, 15 here, 40 here. And in the meantime, you had an existing organization of was called the Ohio Civil Service Employees Association, that represented employees but hadn't had contract bargaining rights up until then, and AFSCME, who, you know, had organized some smaller jurisdictions around the state, who were still much better positioned than we were to ultimately win. So when they had the big statewide elections for the large units, we lost every one of them, and we had spent literally thousands and thousands of dollars and hours trying to win those elections, and with some, you know, some very smart people. I mean, we really had, he brought in some real talent. One of the organizers wound up being a Supreme Court justice here in Ohio. Another one of the organizers brought in ultimately became president of the largest public sector local, CWA public sector local, and public sector local period in the state of New Jersey. Some really talented. So it wasn't for lack of effort. I mean, we certainly made an effort in that regard. But again, that was sort of this marriage of political action and organizing that Marty was shepherding through this period of time. Very effective, and unfortunately the outcome wasn't, you know, what we'd hoped for. But thousands of public workers in the state of Ohio now have a union because of the work he did. And he, anybody who was around at the time will tell you that if there was one person that was responsible for the collective bargaining law in the state of Ohio, aside from the governor saying it's something he wanted to do, it was Marty, and the governor said he wanted to do it because Marty told him he wanted to do it, and made it happen. And we got a really good law out of that period of time.
And that was the late 70s, though, right?
Was trying to do the math on it, I'm guessing 78, 79, somewhere in that time frame. There are others that could tell you the specific date, but I think Celeste was elected in 78, and then so 79 he would have taken office, and it was within the first year that he was there. So I'm guessing 79 is probably the best guess on that.
Well, so just one more question before we close this session, which is, so you know, we know that you go on to have a career as well at the national level with CWA. Mm-hmm. So how do you go from, you know, here in the trenches of the staff in Southern Ohio to that position? Can mm-hmm. can you
sure.
scaffold that for us?
Yeah. As I think I mentioned yesterday, Marty was attracted to me because I could do math. You know, I wasn't an accountant or anything, but I could do math. And so he would rely on me for, just doing a lot of calculations on things. One funny story, a side note, again, this goes back to the way that Marty operated, you know, asked me to interview for a job on Thanksgiving Day. I was, every year, because our contracts had a cost of living clause that I mentioned earlier, had a cost of living clause in them, you would calculate it based on the formula, the consumer price index that came out in April of a particular month, and that would be released in late May. And so then you would do the calculation to figure out, and for every job title, it was a different number. So he would have me every year do this calculation so that we could beat the phone company to the punch. So the moment that consumer price index was released, I would set about to do the calculation and figure out exactly what a service rep was going to be making, what a lineman was going to make, what a top craft was going to make, what a clerical was going to make. You know, the most five or six most populous job titles I would figure out for each one of them. So you were going to get a raise of $25 or whatever it happened to be.
So you knew the boss's costs before they did.
Well, they probably knew it at the same time, but we had an infrastructure to get that message out to the local unions.
Right.
And so beat them to the punch so the boss couldn't claim credit for, oh, I'm giving you this raise. We wanted people to know this was because we negotiated it, and we had, you know, there's a letter that we'd, oh, as a result of our negotiations, blah, 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 here's what people are going to be earning. And it was an effective tool. I mean, people had, again, some ownership of this raise came from, you know, the fact that I was part of a union. So that was one of my jobs. And the one year, a very good friend of mine, I didn't have a lot of money, and she said, well, you know, my parents passed away, and my brother and I inherited this cottage on Cape Cod. And, we rent it out most of the summer. We take it for a couple of weeks ourselves. But, you know, usually I go up there to open it up and get it ready for the season. But if you want, you can go up and open it up and get it ready for the season, and you could stay there for a week. Well, my daughter at the time was 3 or 4, you know, so not in school. And so you opened it up in May, which was also the same time that these consumer price index came about. I said, well, I'd love that. That'd be great. Right on the ocean. It was wonderful. You know, free place. You know, great. Load up the car. I'm going to go. So I picked that week for vacation, and it was also the week that the consumer price index was going to be released. So what I did leading up to that week, you had a sense of where it was going to be, you know, within like a couple of percentage points. And so I did 10 different calculations based on what it could have been for all five of these job titles. Just at evening at home, I would just sit there and do each one and just try and figure out, all right, if the consumer price index goes to here, then this will mean this, 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 this. And so I did 10 different ones. And I gave them to my secretary. And I told her, I said, look, I will call you and let you know which one this actually came out to be. And then, you know, go ahead and, you know, put the letter together based on that. Okay, great. So I drive up to Cape Cod. Literally, they release the number just before I'm ready to leave. So it was probably the night before I left. So I call her up and I say, here's what the number is. Drive to Cape Cod. You know, we left at midnight or something, you know, so you're driving at night, easy drive. Get there, get to the house, go down to this little grocery store. Not even a grocery store, like a little convenient mart, but you know, that's all there was all along the Cape, was just these little mom and pop shops to buy some groceries. And so I go down there, my wife and daughter are back at the house, I'm picking up a bunch of groceries. I go up to the counter, the old guy at the counter, to check out, and he says, is your name Jeff? Yes, it is. How'd you know that? I'm looking at my jacket. Do I have it on my jacket or something? You're supposed to call Marty Hughes. I said, what? What do you mean I'm supposed to call Marty Hughes? He called here earlier, and he said, if you came in, I was to tell you to call him as soon as possible. He had had a secretary call every single little... I told him where I was going to be. I was going to be in East Ham. And he called every single grocery store, little convenient mart, in that whole strip to... that's right. They hadn't released it yet. That's right. The secretary had the numbers, but they hadn't released it yet. That's right. They're going to release it on Monday morning. This is Saturday. So there's no phone at the place. There's no cell phones, obviously. So there's a payphone outside. So I call into the office. This is on a Saturday. We always worked on Saturday. That was, you know, you worked at least a half a day on a Saturday. So I call back to the office and I explain to him. I said, look, I've done the calculations. As soon as they release the number, it'll be one of those 10. I want you back here. But I'm telling you, it'll be one of these numbers. I mean, I've done the math. I know exactly what it's going to be. You know, there's no, I need you here. All right. So I go back to the house, drop the groceries off, tell my wife, drive out to Provincetown where I can catch a plane. Catch a plane to Boston, Boston to Cleveland. Arrive in Cleveland Saturday evening. Maybe they released it on Sunday. I think they did. I think they actually released it on Sunday because they didn't want to release when markets were open. So they released it on Sunday. And I said, well, here it is. It was number 3 on the calculations that I made. We prepared the letter, signed it. He faxed it out. I think we had fax machines back then, or put it in the mail. I think we mailed it, actually. I don't think we even had fax machines. So we mailed it out to everybody at that point. I went to the airport, got a plane, flew back to Boston, back to Provincetown. My car was sitting out there, drove back to the cottage, spent the week at the cottage. He owned you, and you knew it. I mean, it was, you know, like I said, when I read the Cairo books, they just sounded so familiar. It's exactly that way of operating. You know, you were obligated, and he would play that obligation your entire career. And he did. I mean, but again, like Lyndon Johnson, he accomplished some incredible things. You know, some things that didn't work out so great for him either. And so the similarities between the two of them, you know, are different on scale, but not in the way they played out. So, you know, two very powerful individuals who were able to manipulate people in a way that I hadn't been familiar with, and you know, just over time got this increasing awareness of how it happened. You know, he would call you Sunday mornings. There was no restriction. There was no, you know, oh, this is off limits, vacation, nothing. It, you know, you were going to be at his beck and call. And the guy that took his place, Bob Johnson, I'll never forget, his daughter was getting married down in Portsmouth, Ohio. Bob and Sharon had moved up here from Portsmouth, and their daughter had moved up here with them, but her boyfriend was still down in Portsmouth, so they get married, and family and friends were all down in Portsmouth, so the wedding was going to be in Portsmouth. And so Bob was taking the week off before the wedding and a couple days after. And Marty called him up here on Friday before the wedding, the day before the wedding. He needed him up here. You know, some bullshit thing. I don't remember what it was. Bob Dooley came up here. Sharon was madder than a wet hen. I mean, she was pissed. And but Bob came up here and, you know, did whatever Marty needed to do and raced back down to Portsmouth to get down there in time for that wedding on Saturday morning. But it was just, it was this, you know, I would call it an exercise of power, but it was really more an exercise of manipulation. It was just, you know, letting you know, here's what the hierarchy is, here's what the structure is. You've agreed to come on here and that, you know, you've made the deal here with the devil, and so you're going to continue to pay the price throughout, you know, the time that you're working for me.
Were there rewards for loyalty?
You know, I guess the rewards for loyalty was, you know, you got increased responsibility, I suppose. I never got promoted by Marty. I was always a staff rep. As soon as Bob became vice president, he promoted me to an assistant role. I literally functioned as his assistant for the last 3 or 4 years that he was vice president. His office, we were on a different floor in the same building, and his office had two doors, one door that went out to his secretary, and the second door went to a connecting office, and I was in that connecting office. You know, I mean, I literally was functioning in that role. So I guess the reward was the attaboys, you know, more than anything else. You know, but I don't want to be that cold about it because I felt good about what I was doing. You know, you like the work, you enjoy the work. At each step, if I pleased the boss, I was able to do more meaningful pieces of the work, given more trust to do more of the work. And so, you know, like you train a pet dog, I was being trained to be the pet dog here. And the reward was, you know, I got a pat on the head and okay, now you can have the run of the backyard, you know. Again, I that piece of my career led to, you know, bigger pieces later on. So my reward, as they say, came in heaven as I moved on later on in my career. And as I indicated, so Bob Johnson, when he became vice president, we had two states, and Marty had two people in sort of assistant positions, one in Michigan, Mike Handley, and one down here in Ohio, Bob Johnson. And both were perceived as sort of contenders to take over when Marty left. And I can tell a story another time about Marty's departure. But Bob wound up getting that job. Again, there's a whole story behind that. And he made Mike his number two person and promoted him to the assistant job. There's like a hierarchy. So you've got the vice president, the assistant, and then a couple of administrative assistants. And he promoted me to administrative assistant. But I functioned as the assistant because I was here co-located with him. But Mike got the assistant title just out of, you know, here's, you know, the perception that the two of them were the leaders. And Mike really led the entire operation for us up in Michigan. So, you know, he had a different kind of role than I had, where I was more of the support role. Mike was actually in a leadership role up in Michigan. So I was the administrative assistant and stayed in that same office adjacent to the vice president's office. But Marty's departure. So Marty was accused by the federal government of improper campaign contributions. what he would do, CWA restricted the money that he could have in order to make campaign contributions. So Marty would take and fill out a voucher in the name of the politician, and put mileage down as an expense that this politician was working, doing something on behalf of the union. CWA send it into Washington. CWA would issue a check. They would send it here. Marty would give that check to that elected official. He would then report it. It wasn't like it went unreported. This wasn't some under the table thing. He reported under, you know, Ohio state law. You know, so and so got, you know, $100, $150. They weren't big numbers ever. They were never ever big numbers. Any rate, the FBI came in and, you know, they just ripped the place apart, went through all kinds of things. I mean, clearly he was making fraudulent claims. I mean, these people never did that mileage. But, you know, again, the money was reported as a campaign contribution. It was, the fraud was between internally in CWA. He was lying to CWA headquarters about what these people were doing and he was also obviously forging the signature because he had to sign off on a voucher if you incurred the expense. So he would sign, you know, the elected official's name or the candidate's name. And so he was charged on, I forget, 17 counts or something, and wound up being convicted on three, and then given probation by the judge, which is another interesting story. This story is so complicated and complex. So when Marty was sort of at, I don't want to say the peak of his power, but he became an early supporter of Jimmy Carter. And got himself in good with a number of people in the Carter White House, Hamilton Jordan in particular. And there were two federal judge vacancies in Ohio. And Howard Metzenbaum and John Glenn were our senators. And they each nominated somebody for the job, and which is the way these things roll out. You know, the Senate gets picked. So John Glenn picked an African-American by the name of George White. And Howard Metzenbaum, who had been CWA's attorney, Howard Metzenbaum was, before he ran for public office. Howard Metzenbaum selected Ann Aldrich. Marty and Howard had gotten into a little bit of a tiff over the years. You know, they'd worked together closely over time, and whatever the rift was, they fell out a little bit. So both nominated, both confirmed by the Senate, unanimous votes, as it was in the day, and wind up on the president's desk for appointment. Marty calls Hamilton Jordan and says, can you do me a favor? Can you pull Ann Aldrich's nomination and just hold it for a day? He does. George White gets signed and now has one day of seniority over Ann Aldrich. And ultimately winds up becoming the chief of the bench here in Northeast Ohio. FBI investigates Marty, you know, goes through all his machinations, overcharged. I mean, they just went way overboard. And the stuff he was convicted of, while wrong, really should have been an internal issue. I mean, it should have been something CWA resolved, because he was really lying to the union. He wasn't lying to anybody else. But anyway, they charge him, and, you know, you go to the federal courthouse, and, you know, there's several federal judges down there, and they do this paraffin draw, you know. Of course, he draws Ann Aldrich. Now, Marty has told this story to a number of people over the years. Ann Aldrich certainly knows that she is one day less seniority because Marty Hughes had Hamilton Jordan pull her nomination and set it back a day. So that's the judge he draws. To be absolutely fair, Ann Aldrich could not have been more fair to him. I mean, to her credit, she was she threw out a bunch of the charges, left these other charges in. He was convicted on three of them, and they were really the minor charges, and gave him probation. I mean, you couldn't really have asked for a better outcome if, you know, if you were Marty. But once he was convicted, President Barr at the time said, you know, that's it. You know, he's supported you. He allowed Marty to stay while the trial was pending, and, you know, stayed hung in there with him throughout the whole thing. But once he was convicted, you're done. You're out. And he calls Marty to tell him this. Marty tells Bob Johnson, he says, I want you to fly to D.C., and I want you to plead my case to stay in pending appeal. Bob says, okay, I'll do it. But, you know, Marty knows there's already enough tension between him and Morty at this point that, you know, that his making the personal appeal is not going to do it. So he sends Bob, who's well-liked. Bob goes up there, and Morty says, no, he's out. And as a matter of fact, as long as you're here, I'm swearing you in as vice president. If he'd sent Mike Handley up there, Mike would have been the vice president. But he sent Bob Johnson. So, you know, the configuration, here's Marty's office. My office is attached to it. I know what Bob's been sent up there to do. Bob calls me on the phone. He's whispering. He says, can you talk? Yeah. What's going on? I've just been sworn in as vice president. What? That's not what you were supposed to go up there to do. I know. I haven't told Marty yet. I said, well, are you calling me to ask me to tell him? He says, would you? Tell him I'm on a plane on my way back. Okay. So I go in and tell Marty. I said, Marty, it didn't work. Bob just called. He's getting on a plane. Morty swore him in as vice president. He gets on the phone to Morty right away and, you know, pleads his case, but it's over. It's done. And so Marty is out. But he's sure he's going to win on appeal. And he doesn't leave his office. Stays in his office. Bob stays in his office. Bob's the vice president now, but Marty continues to function largely as the vice president, although not directly, you know, but he's working with Bob on whatever goes on. Finally, after, I don't know, 6 weeks of this going on, I go to Marty's office. And, you know, now at this point, I'm fed up. I respect this guy. I testified on his behalf in this trial. I said, Marty, you're not being fair to Bob. Bob has been the most loyal guy you've ever had. He's the vice president now. You've got to leave this office, and you've got to let him become the vice president. I mean, he's got the title, but he doesn't have the job. And we had a credit union that was just down the hall. And Marty was chairman of the board of this credit union. It's a credit union I'm the chairman of the board of now. And I said, I'm gonna come in on Saturday with one of the other staff guys, and we're gonna move your stuff out of the office. Where do you want me to take it? Leave it alone. I'll move it. You know, he's pissed at me. Okay, but I'm gonna be here Saturday, and if it isn't moved, I'm gonna move it. All right, so Saturday I get one of the other guys, Dave Derrick, and the two of us come up here. And we had given, several years ago, Marty was a notorious catnapper. I mean, it was just, he drew this energy from it. So he could take like a 20-minute power nap. And so 1 year, all the staff pitched in and bought him a couch. That, you know, like a, not like a meeting couch, but like a take a nap on couch, you know. You know, I'm figuring, all right, we're going to have to haul this couch out of here, take it, you know, down the hall to this other office over here. And we come up here, get off the elevator on the fourth floor, and here's Marty's wife, Natalie, who's a saint. She is, I don't know what your perception of heaven and hell is, but if you believe there's a heaven, Natalie Hughes is in heaven. We would go out to a restaurant, Natalie would look at the menu, decide what she wanted, then order the cheapest thing on the menu, and the difference in price she would donate to the church the next morning. You know, so if she wanted a $12 steak back in the day, but they had, you know, $4 macaroni and cheese, she would get the macaroni and cheese, she would take that $8 and donate it the next day to the church. You know, the hair shirt. I mean, just, you know, this is who this person was. Here's Natalie Hughes pulling this couch by herself out of the office. Natalie, stop. Let us do that. You know, you can't do that. She says, no, Marty told me I have to. No, Natalie, leave it alone. We will take care of it. Oh, he's going to be mad. Natalie, I don't really care. You know, let him get mad at me. It's fine. I'm taking it out of here. We're moving this couch. So we moved the couch. You know, he got pissed at us, but I just went in there, and he was, you know, his office was just of, you see the pictures of Einstein's desk, you know, and just a mass of papers everywhere, boxes are here and there. You know, I got all the boxes, boxed up all the papers on his desk, you know, hauled everything down the hall to an office that was vacant down the hall, and moved him out of there. And, you know, he eventually got over it. But, you know, it was always very resentful of what I did. But, you know, the reality was it just wasn't healthy for the union. You know, whether or not he was the best guy leading the district, which he was, you know, he was incredibly talented. He wasn't, number one, respecting the guy that was a successor, but number two, you know, his union had said, you're done. And so, you know, we had to take steps to move him out. So I'm sorry, I got way off track on that, but that's, you know.
It illustrates a lot of points, I think, if you really dig into that story. I think just even for purposes of time, I think, and just because that's such a good story to end on, let's end this session on that story, because clearly that helps move you in the direction that you're ultimately going to go in.
Yeah.
So with your permission, I'm going to turn this off, all right?
Sure.